This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Another accuser, a new video, and more calls for Randy Andy Nipples Ring Gambino's resignation in New York State. We find another young woman who doesn't understand. She just doesn't seem to get Andrew Cuomo's madcap sense of humor.
Yeah, he's just joking around, Dan. He's just trying, you know, add some levity during a pandemic. That's what he's doing, you know.
During a pandemic or at a wedding where his latest accuser, who's, I believe, 33 years old, or was at the time, of the two, Anna Ruck is her name. Rush, I'm not sure how
to go with
the pronunciation. She told the New York Times the governor made advances toward her and kissed her on her cheek at a New York City wedding reception. Within moments of being introduced at the wedding, the woman claims Randy Andy put his hand on the small of her lower back. I promptly removed his hand with my hand, which I would have thought was a clear enough indicator that I was not wanting him to touch me. But then she said she was shocked when he placed his hands on her cheeks and asked if he could kiss her.
Aggressively placed her hands on her cheeks. And there's proof of it, folks, too, if you haven't seen the photo yet.
Yeah, there's some photos from the wedding of him doing that. That's an odd how do you do introduction to somebody you've apparently never met until that event.
That means he's an aggressive D-bag. Is what that means. Well, I've had men come and touch me, like the small, the back, like, hey, how you doing? And, you know, you do the woman thing. You step away, like, excuse me, hi, nice to meet you. And you try to keep it cordial and friendly when you really want to kick them in the naughty bits. Mm-hmm. But you don't, because you're in a public place and you just want to get the message across. But for him to grab her, that picture, that is your space. That is your invading your private space. And when he grabbed her, I wanted to punch him when I saw that picture. I thought that was disgusting.
Your time as a reporter for NBC5 in Chicago, Did you ever have a governor, maybe a big Jim Thompson or a Jim Thompson, Ryan? Did he ever ask you to eat an Italian sausage sandwich in front of you?
In front of him, I mean? Excuse me? No.
Yeah.
No.
This from a state fair event in 2016, video of Angie Cuomo, Randy Andy.
I like Nipples Ring Gambino.
Yeah, Nipples Ring Gambino is good.
Randy Andy was reserved for the Royals.
Well, I mean, I think it has application here. He asked a News 12 reporter named Beth Cefalu to eat the whole sausage, quote unquote, in a video that's surfaced. Here's a little snippet from that video.
I don't know if I should eat the whole sausage in front of you, but I'm definitely going to eat it.
No excuses.
And followed up with what? And eat the banana next? I mean, we know what he's implying. He's a sick pervert.
Cefalu then asked to take a selfie with the governor, and he jokes, there's too much sausage in that selfie.
Oh, who? And he's been getting away with it because he's the governor.
He is now facing calls for his resignation, not just from some of the usual suspects like Mayor Warren Wilhelm, who those two socialists don't get along anyway, but also first member of the New York State Congressional Delegation, Democrat Kathleen Rice, joining de Blasio, a.k.a. Warren Wilhelm, in calling for his resignation, and that includes a number of state assembly Democrats that have called for his impeachment and or resignation as well. Does he survive? He may, because there's a high bar to remove him from office. But obviously he's going to be greatly diminished, as is his celebrity status.
Well, why weren't these Democrats calling for his resignation when he fudged the nursing home number deaths? But now they're coming forward? You know what I mean? I just, that's what rubs me the wrong way, is that they weren't there when people were dying. 9,000 people didn't die in nursing homes, 15,000 plus, and it may be even more.
If you want to
grab a chick by the face and tell her to eat a sausage in front of her, well, now we're going to stand up for something. Now we're pissed off.
If you want to be rubbed the wrong way, I could introduce you to Randy Andy Cuomo. Fredo and Randy Andy, they're brothers.
Yeah, don't you know? Which one's
Marcus,
hotter?
The Marcus twins, Gumbel to Gumbel Beach Justice. There's something there. I'm still workshopping it. Fredo took time on his show yesterday to explain why he can no longer cover his brother during these episodes.
Before we start tonight, let me say something that I'm sure is very obvious to you who watch my show. And thank you for that. You're straight with me, I'll be straight with you. Obviously, I'm aware of what's going on with my brother. And obviously, I cannot cover it because he is my brother. Now, of course, CNN has to cover it. They have covered it extensively, and they will continue to do so. I have always cared very deeply about these issues, and profoundly so. I just wanted to tell you that.
Deeply embarrassed.
There's a lot of news going on that matters also. So
let's get after that. The way that Andy Cuomo gets after a bridesmaid at a wedding. Obviously, I cannot cover negative news about my brother. Unlike, obviously, I could use my show and CNN to lionize my brother's handling of COVID, play Q-tip grab ass with him, help him sell books, discuss his POTUS ambitions, and yuck it up about his dating life. He's such a swordsman, my brother.
Remember, they're considering him being Attorney General and possible VP to Biden?
Yeah. They were considering him replacing Biden as the nominee just a year ago.
Right. A little grabby, huh?
Obviously, what Fredo Cuomo can't do because it's his brother, so he's conflicted. Mm-hmm. But obviously, back in June of 2020, it went more like this.
I just hope you recognize what even I'm able to recognize, being spawned from the same wolf pack.
Oh, my God.
I hope you are able to appreciate what you did in your state and what it means for the rest of the country now and what it will always mean to those who love and care about you the most. I'm wowed by what you did. And more importantly, I'm wowed by how you did it. This was very hard. I know it's not over, but obviously I love you as a brother. Obviously, I'll never be objective. Obviously, I think you're the best politician in the country. But I hope you feel good about what you did for your people, because I know they appreciate it. Nothing's perfect. You'll have your critics.
Thank you.
But I've never seen anything like what you did. That's why I'm so happy to have had you on the show. Hope you know that.
Real hard to get his brother on the line.
Somebody get that Yale graduate a thesaurus so he uses another adverb besides obviously? Obviously this and obviously that. By the way, if it's obvious, you don't need to say obviously. So there's no conflict when it comes to putting your brother on a pedestal and servicing him the way that you just heard Fredo service him. But when it comes to this ugliness, self-inflicted, the correcting of the record, maybe. Oh, no. I can't cover that because in response to that sycophancy you just heard from Fredo, this is what Nipples Ring Gambino had to say.
So you just do what's right. I did what was right. I'm comfortable with what I did. I think the facts bear it out. I think the numbers bear it out. I think we saved tens of thousands of lives. But I did what was right.
Pat myself on the back. Won an International Daytime Emmy.
I did what was right.
Right.
If you had suborned that sort of perjury on your show, would you want to correct the record? Obviously, Chris Cuomo doesn't. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Jim in Crown Point.
The governor is every other inch a gentleman, so he should be excused for that. His brother, this is how stupid he is. He should shut his mouth, not even comment, because all he did was sweep it under the rug. He tried to minimize the crime. I've punched two guys in my life that touched my wife, hit them hard.
Was one of them named Cuomo?
Was it at a wedding?
I wish it was. But the guy would get drunk and put his hands on women in the group. He was a good friend, and everybody was outraged. I said, look, nobody, it's inappropriate. And I said, you're all, you enable this. Also,
stuff. Stuff
I meant.
Yes.
And then Biden's Uncle Joe.
G-rated radio.
Joe Biden's Uncle Joe. You know, the lovable uncle.
Yeah, the hair sniffer.
Yeah.
The let me get you from behind and sniff your hair. Yeah, that's not creepy. Hello?
No, none of it is. So I just hope this guy, they lock him up.
Well, he thinks
I'm sorry
for interrupting, but I mean, he thinks he's a king. Only a truly narcissistic, flamboyant, out of control man could go up and grab somebody he doesn't even know and grab them by the face at a wedding. I mean, he was looking for some. Excuse me if I tell you how the life works, Dan.
That's just his zany sense of humor.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Greg and LaGrange.
Jokey.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Hi.
Amy, you deserve a lot of credit for that comment this morning. I think listening to this stuff today, in the Cuomo and the womanizing thing is one thing, okay? That's a separate, deplorable set of events. But the whole nursing home care thing and now the stuff that's coming out about Whitmer and wanting her to disclose numbers, the thing that gets me the most is why now? Why now with the media trying to go after this stuff? Why now? These deaths were horrible when they occurred. And why are they newsworthy now? I find the press to be one of the most abhorrent group
lazy,
of cheerleaders
lazy,
ever.
Lazy.
No, it's not lazy.
No, in Chicago, it's lazy. I've been sitting there. I had a front row seat to laziness. No one studies. No one reads. No one wants to tip the boat, rock the boat.
Yeah.
You know what that means, though? But what? That means that we are. That means that we are not being fed the truth. And when you see guys at Substack go after Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald, the way they're going after them, you know there's a serious disconnect with our news organizations, and they need to be looked at. This is terrible.
Thanks for the call, Greg. It's a combination. So you have a herd of journalists, so-called journalists, that are lazy, and they get fed and directed by the shepherds, the Zuckers of the world, the Dave Remnicks over at New Yorker. So there's laziness, but there's also perniciousness. There's also agendas that are advanced by the leaders, the shepherds of the sheep, the Baquettes at New York Times. So it's a combination of the two. And this is what you're seeing playing out with Chris Cuomo, Chris Cuomo's brother, Nipples Ring Gambino. And one wonders if maybe this is a predicate to running the same operation on Joe Biden and ushering him off stage left to usher in Kamala Harris at some point. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Former President Obama on a podcast with Bruce Springsteen.
He's so woke.
It was the real intellectual foray between the two of them. The topic of reparations came up, and President Obama said, he met white resistance to his support for reparations back during his presidency. Gosh, I don't remember much talk of his support for reparations, his interest in opening that dialogue, that national dialogue during his 8 years as president. But now, removed and with reparations becoming more popular within Black Lives Matter and other Marxist circles, all of a sudden he wants to, be au courant. And so he's going to rewrite his history to try and make himself relevant in the present. That's what Obama's doing. Meanwhile, Evanston, Illinois, the home of Tony Northwestern University, becomes the first city in the nation to set up a reparations fund for its residents. It was profiled on Good Morning America this week, the city of Evanston, and the Fifth Ward alderman there, who has led the charge for reparations. Her name is Robin Rue Simmons, and this is what she had to say about the need for reparations in Evanston.
This is my home. It's where I live. I love it. My people are here. This community was redlined historically, and that has come along with damages that continue today. Resources were stripped away from the black community, and that stripped away a sense of place and wealth as well.
We've been doing the work, and the work that we've done has not produced any relief in the racial disparities that we have. And it was appropriate that we do something radically different to make good on the commitment that we've made to the black community. And reparations was the next thing for us to do. When I introduced reparations in Evanston, it was always the first step of many to come. There is a lifetime of work ahead of me and my children for us to get to justice for the black community. And I can't wait to celebrate the family that receives their first reparation benefit. I cannot wait for that day.
And the reparation benefit will come in this form: $10 million fund, $1 million a year for 10 years, will be distributed in increments of up to $25,000 per eligible resident to use for housing. So essentially, up to $25,000 grants to any eligible resident in Evanston to use for housing. This is going to be funded, by the way, by a local tax on marijuana. Which is a fascinating way to do this, much like gambling to fund schools. But anyway, she suggests that whites and blacks partake in marijuana at about the same rate, so there's equity in the funding source. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. What do you think of this reparations fund in Evanston? Maybe... hopefully, I'm sure, right? Coming to a community near you.
People are going to, if your house is for sale in Evanston right now, it might sell quicker if you're, you know, an ancestor of slaves. But how are you going to, first of all, prove that you deserve reparations? Was that discussed at all? Or you could just, if you're African American, you could just apply. I mean, that seems fraught with danger. And who's going to decide who is really telling the truth and who is faking it?
Yeah, I think that's a secondary issue. The particular rigors of applying for these $25,000 grants, I assume it will be, basically, if I don't know that you have to do it ancestry.com. I think basically if you're black in Evanston, then you're eligible and you queue up for your $25,000. I don't know if there's, I haven't looked into it. Because the top line question is more interesting than the sort of process of it. But, if it's being done by age or anything like that. But $25,000, by the way.
That's good money. I mean, that's great.
Is it great? Mm-hmm. Do you think this is a good idea?
Oh, I don't think this is a good idea. No. I mean, and also, too, is this going to make everything better? Is BLM going to go away now? Is everything going to, are we all going to live in harmony now if we pay people to say, we're so sorry what happened to your ancestors? I mean, should the Norwegians pay the Swedes? Because we were slaves to them for a while. I mean, should we start something like that? I mean, where is this going to end? If you open up that door, it's going to, I don't see it ending anytime soon, because then it's going to happen in Chicago and New York and LA and then all over the country.
Well, that's the plan of BLM and the other race hustlers, isn't it? That's what I understand. She said that this is an attempt to repay black residents of Evanston for the wrongs and accumulated losses incurred by generations of racism. You heard at the outset talking about redlining, and they enlisted some identitarian academic to document some of the manifestations of racism in Evanston over the years. And of course, like everywhere else in the country, I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that people living under Jim Crow, Jim Crow laws, which is mainly in the South, but other such racist practices, redlining was mentioned and so forth. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And, they go back to 40 acres and a mule, and that promise was some was significantly unfulfilled, and the disparity in wealth accumulated by blacks and whites, the disparity in household income between blacks and whites in Evanston. Oh, by the way, $25,000 grant for housing. Mm-hmm. The median home price in Evanston is about $440,000.
Really?
So, I mean, just in terms of, you know, coming up with 20% down and being able to afford a house in that price point or higher, find a house, first of all, then afford one, although maybe even Evanston people are fleeing. You know, that's no simple thing, and $25,000 would certainly help for perhaps some people, but I don't know if it's going to be
a game changer,
determinative. But again, the larger issue is this a good idea generally? Well, one longtime Evanston resident who came to Evanston in 1959, his name is Benjamin Gaines Sr. He's 98 years old. He was interviewed by Good Morning America with his son. And this is what he had to say about reparations.
The contractor,
he said, so it's completely out. He said, you find a lot anywhere in Evanston, and I'll build whatever you want.
Well, when he said that, he meant in the black neighborhoods. It was just the way it was. And as we speak, in 2021, we still have these same types of problems.
That's interesting. Is that the case? I mean, in woke socialist Evanston, that the same problems exist that existed in 1959? Could Mr. Gaines be right? And if he is right, well, then whose fault would that be? How many Republicans are running around driving the train in Evanston? This is a town that has been beset by conservative Republican leadership. They just elected Socialist Dan Biss, and they've had many socialists before him, not to mention the aldermen. So what's the problem in Evanston if Mr. Gaines is right? You can't have it both ways. Either it's still 1959 in Evanston, and you have leftists to blame, or it's not, and they're running a scam. Which is it?
Yeah. And if you've driven through Evanston, you've seen the signs everywhere. They say reparations is a positive solution to economic disparity, and then in black letters, we all win.
Mr. Gaines is a supporter.
You have denied me all my 98 years. Hopefully, before I die, I'll see the world change.
And get some reparations.
And get some reparations, right.
You know, with all due respect to Mr. Gaines, you're telling me in 98 years you haven't seen the world change? You haven't seen America change in your 98 years as it pertains to race relations or by any other measure? I mean, that's just not credible. I'm sorry. But it speaks to this mentality that, unfortunately, is pushed by race hustlers, that nothing has changed in America since 1959, this basically, it's still 1963 Birmingham in most of the country. And that's just not true.
Well, they claim in this 70-page report that discrimination and racism in Evanston is dated back to the late 1800s.
Well, no kidding.
Well, I know. I'm just...
Yes, we're all very well aware of the history of America. And nobody's defending slavery or Jim Crow or other racist policies, whether they were under the color of law or culturally. The question is, what does America look like today? What is your understanding of history and the evolution on this issue of race and race relations? And is this an appropriate response to past wrongs? Those are the questions. Did you know slavery existed? Yeah, I got it. I know. And it's not, nobody's dismissing it. That's you have to explain why it's relevant. And the way they explain its relevance to make their argument for them is to say the legacy of slavery and other racist laws and other racist cultural mores over generations still afflicts black Americans today, and this is the reason why there are wealth and other such disparities when it comes to self-sufficiency and wherewithal, particularly financially, and thus reparations. That's essentially the argument they make. Clay and Wheeling.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. 2 points real quick. The first one being, you open that door, you're never going to close it. It will never, ever, ever be good enough. It won't. It'll always be more and more and more. My second point is, I'm Polish and Irish. My people were discriminated against when they first came to this country back in the 1900s. I'm not equating it to slavery, but they were definitely discriminated against. Weren't allowed in certain areas. Weren't allowed to work in certain places. Do I get reparations then? Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Clay. Star Parker, who went from welfare to success in life, she is taking up the topic in an op-ed. My ancestors were slaves, and my life as a young woman was a mess. Was my life a mess because my ancestors were slaves? I don't think so. My life was a mess because I lived a wanton, irresponsible existence defined by promiscuity, petty crimes, and scamming the nation's well-meaning but totally confused welfare system to the greatest extent of my ability. Did I need reparations to turn things around for me? Certainly not. I needed a wake-up call, which to my great gratitude I got from a few church-going black Christians who told me the way I was living was irresponsible. I went to church, took basic responsibility for my life, and turned my circumstances around. The problem, she writes, with the idea of reparations is it redirects attention away from exactly where attention is needed, on individuals' personal responsibility for their own unique lives. That's my biggest problem with reparations as well, that it continues this assault on individual agency, and it continues to gaslight black Americans into thinking they are victims, they are perpetual victims, they can do nothing on their own sans government and or the white man. And it's wrong. And it is so destructive. So destructive. Kip in Stillman Valley.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, first off, real quick, you might guys remember EJ, right? Calls in a lot. He passed away, so... Other than that, I think that this is terrible. Any kind of reparations in any city or any state or in our country, you know, slavery began Egypt, the Jews. What have they got for reparations? You know, I mean, granted, slavery was terrible, but if I'm not mistaken, it was the Democratic Party and the Democrat people that were all for all that. And it's not fair for the people that sacrificed their lives through the wars that we fought for our freedoms, for everyone in our great nation to be free. It's not just a white nation or a black nation. We are a melting pot, and we are going so far from that anymore with this identical politics and cancel culture and all the other. It's mind-boggling, it's heartbreaking, and this is just terrible, and come on, comrades, you know, I mean, we are in a communist nation. We're going so fast that way right now.
Thanks, Kip, appreciate it. I think what you're hearing from Kip and from Clay and I'm sure from others is this idea, it speaks to what this does. It just divides by identity.
Right.
Further balkanizes America.
Yeah, I think this is going to hurt race relations rather than help it.
Terry in Rogers Park right next door.
I wonder if Evanston's real estate value will go way down because of this.
Or it might go up. I mean, who knows?
Thanks for the call, Terry. I think real estate values are going to go down everywhere in Illinois because of property taxes. It has nothing to do with race. That's also something that knows no race, is the destruction of home value of property taxes in Illinois. But don't get me off on
that. Yeah, no. Don't go there, Dan.
Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. When you first played the reel of that guy, I thought that was Sloppy Rush in the beginning. It sounds just like him. Hey, you know what? I don't know if you guys heard, but Stevie Wonder is talking about moving back to Ghana because he doesn't want his grandchildren brought up in such a horrible country like the United States. So I'd recommend that this guy and anybody else who doesn't like living here could just, you know, go online, get an airline ticket, and move out of Dodge. You guys have a good one.
Thanks, Greg. Mary Kay in Western Springs.
Yeah, this lady, Robin Russom, and she, this is justice, you know. My thing is, you can't be poor and white and grow up in an underfunded neighborhood. You can't be. That happens all the time, right? You can grow up and be poor, and I can want justice. Give me $25,000. I could use it, you know. I mean, why don't I deserve any reparations? It's just a bunch of bull jive, and, again, it promotes the victim mentality, and you keep doing that, nothing will change. Just generation to generation, give me money to justify my poor existence. And Amy, you're right. It will never end. It will never end. I agree.
Thanks, Mary Kay. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You don't have to live like you live in Illinois. And this is not another Chamber of Commerce pitch for Florida or South Dakota either.
Or Indiana. Yeah, because I go there every weekend still just to feel free.
It's for Iowa. Kim Reynolds, the governor there, signed legislation passed by the General Assembly that requires every public and accredited private school in Iowa, everyone, to offer in-person learning 5 days a week.
Oh, God bless her.
Every single one.
God bless that woman.
And what Kim Reynolds did before moving in this direction is sit in on Zoom calls between school board members and parents, educators and parents. And she recounts in this piece about her, the action that she took, memorialized by Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. This is perfect. I wonder if you've had a similar circumstance, similar occurrence. She was watching the interaction between a school board and a parent who's a professor at Iowa State University. The Iowa State University professor explained that she was teaching in person, and she offered to walk the school board, school where her child attends, to walk the school board through the mitigation measures the university had put in place such that she felt comfortable being in the classroom at Iowa State in Ames. School board said, go pound sand. Yeah. They said, quote, if you want your child to be in the classroom, then you should just go buy a house in the neighboring district.
And Reynolds, driving customers away. Okay. Yeah.
Reynolds says, now just how unconscionable is that? That was sort of when she had enough and she got the sense of what was actually going on here, which was people flexing their political muscles for their personal benefit or for the benefit of their political allies and to the detriment of the students first and the families that they're supposed to serve and the haughtiness of it all. Much like you've heard from any number of the school board exchanges we've played on this show, including most recently from La Mesa Spring Valley School District in California, where you had the vice president of the school board say even having a conversation about reopening the schools was illegitimate, and that to reopen the schools and force kids to attend school was tantamount to slavery. That finally drew some reaction from parents in that district. But that's what Kim Reynolds has done in Iowa. That exists in Iowa. It exists in the private schools that so many CPS teachers send their kids to. It exists in the private schools that so many teachers' union bosses from Berkeley to Alexandria, Virginia, send their kids to. It just doesn't exist for a lot of your kids.
In California, Governor Newsom and the state legislatures there, I don't know if you heard this yesterday, signed a deal, $4.6 billion they'll give to schools all over California if they are open by March 29th. So they have a month to get their, you know what, together.
As if that's the issue.
It's not the issue. He's just trying not to get recalled because parents now are starting to, you know, wanting to, for in-person learning, because we should have already had that. Like the 30 other states that have had it since the beginning of August, and the Catholic schools and the private schools.
Yeah, you mentioned the Berkeley boss.
Oh, yes.
Yesterday.
Who's so hip. He's got dreads. He's a white dude. Yeah.
His kids being dropped off at his teachers union apparatchik. His kids being dropped off at a private school.
He's dropping them off, and he's even got a Berkeley teachers union jacket on. And he has said in the past, Dan, we can't get kids won't wear masks. They'll take them off, while he's holding his 3-year-old daughter's hand, who has a mask on, and he drops her off at preschool.
Alexandria, Virginia City Public School Superintendent Gregory Hutchings has been proud to call himself a parent of two children who attend public school. But now he pulled one of his kids from public school, which is remaining all virtual, and enrolled one of his kids in a private Catholic school following a hybrid model. I can confirm that our family made a decision to change my daughter's school this school year. Decisions like these are very personal family decisions, are not taken lightly. This in no way impacts my lifelong commitment to public education, to which I remain as personally dedicated as ever. The superintendent has been an opponent of pod-based learning, you know, parents getting together and creating these, you know, little consortiums, because that causes inequities. But it's okay if he sends his kid to a Catholic school, which also causes inequities because, one, I'll bet you dollars to donuts, it's a better school than his daughter was otherwise attending. Two, it's certainly a better school when they're doing in-person learning, and his daughter's public school is not. Oh, but when they make the decision, it's very personal for my family. So it's different. What I do personally has no weight, is not to be considered as it pertains to the public policy positions I take. And you know what? A lot of people buy that two-step, apparently. Or they don't know. What is it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Well, and quickly, yesterday, CPS, 30,000 students went back to school for hybrid learning. I mean, we fought so hard for, what, 2 days? Ooh, but it's a start. And Mayor Lightfoot visited kids at Hawthorne Elementary.
I spoke with one young second grader and said, what are you hoping for today? And he said, well, I really want to make some new friends.
It's so sad and sickening what we did to our kids. Here's a fifth grader at Hawthorne.
Kind of lonely at sometimes because I couldn't really interact with my friends.
And she was so excited to go back to school to see her teachers and to see her friends and to, you know, try to go back to some normalcy. And this was child abuse. They should have been back in school in August. There's no reason, but you had the teachers union and thugs like that who just thought it wasn't safe.
Excuse me, the teachers union and triple threat and the entire political ruling class in Chicago and Illinois.
Yeah, they were scared. They weren't sure. Oh, if the one kid dies or if one teacher dies. And Jesse Sharkey yesterday, of course, well, there's, you know, this isn't going to last because there's going to be cases and there's not enough teachers.
Is there enough staff out there at all the CPS schools?
No, there won't be enough staff. I mean, it's a pandemic school. Even if everyone was back, we still wouldn't have enough staff. Paying full attention to someone online is a job. And then there's an additional job where you're trying to pay full attention to someone who's there in person.
Right. Well, there's no such thing as ever having enough staff in CPS, according to the Chicago Teachers Union. There's no such thing. You could have one support staffer plus one teacher per child, and that would not be enough staff. So let's just understand the baseline from which you're starting when we talk about these Marxist teachers unions. Some other points with respect to first Chicago and then what's happening at the federal level and what's included in that Biden $1.9 trillion of funny money spend.
Yeah. How much is Chicago going to get?
In Chicago, it wasn't just the teachers that were getting paid to dubiously work during remote learning. It's not just government workers being paid to, generally speaking, to dubiously work during the shutdowns and the lockdowns and the closeouts. The Safe Passage ambassadors that CPS has retained to walk kids to school because that's how unsafe Chicago is.
They kept their jobs. I see them walking around. It's like Hotel Rwanda. They're pretending that there's fake kids that they're escorting to and from school.
Yeah, $4.3 million has been expended this year, even while the schools have been closed. So there's been no students passaging to school. But that doesn't mean the Safe Passage Yellow Jackets aren't being paid. Of course they're being paid. At the federal level, this is worth noting. A provision here that has been underreported is just starting to get some notice. Under this proposal that's pending in the Senate, enables a new Treasury Department fund called the Emergency Federal Employee Leave Fund to pay federal employees up to $1,400 a week for 15 weeks as pay time off if they have any kids who are not enrolled in full-time in-classroom instruction at their school. $1,400 a week for up to 15 weeks paid time off if they have kids who are not enrolled in full-time in-classroom instruction. So you're scrambling if your kid's school is shut down or is just doing remote learning or is even in a hybrid format, because this is full-time in-classroom instruction. Full-time in-classroom instruction. You're scrambling. Perhaps a mom has to stay home now, had to quit her job, or you're recalibrating your household budget because of what's going on. You're certainly recalibrating your schedules to accommodate your kids and be there when they're remote learning at home and so forth. If you're a federal employee, you can get paid $1,400 a week to do that.
That is so not fair. They're placating to the unions, and they don't care about working moms. And more than a million, I think, what is it, 2.2 million women have left the workforce because they've had to take care of their children. What about subsidizing them? I mean, honestly.
You get subsidized if you're a federal employee. If you're in on the scam, then
you benefit from the scam?
You get cut in, right? If you're part of the scam, you get to wet your beak. If you're not part of it, you get to pay for those who get to wet their beak. Do you understand?
Yeah, but that's bull jive, and they should not be doing it. I mean, any mom knows electric bill has doubled, grocery bill has tripled. And you can't go in your house. You're held hostage from your house because they have to be quiet places because they're learning.
Mike on the south side.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I want to know what your take is on vouchers for kids. I think as a parent, because I have three in public school in the city, which I'm going crazy. But if I was given half of the amount of money that each kid requires per year, choose the school I want to send them
to. There you
go.
Amen.
I'd be more than happy. And we could save everybody money in the long run.
So, Mike, are you familiar with Empower Illinois?
No.
Okay. So go to empowerillinois.org. I'm serious here. This is the tax credit scholarship program that was set up a couple of years ago. And it provides for scholarships of up to $13,000 per year per child, or $26,000 per year per child if the child has a disability, to go to a school of their choice. And
I'm doing it today.
Yeah, empowerillinois.org. Get your kid. I mean, I'm talking to you, but I'm talking beyond you. General statement. Get your kids on a voluntarily funded lifeboat out of these ghastly government school systems, away from these Marxist apparatchiks. I'm sorry, but yes, there are good teachers in CPS. They are overwhelmed by the teachers' union and the apparatchiks there, as you see them march in force in their red shirts, 10 and 15 and 20,000 en masse when they are protesting for this or for that, explaining why they don't want to work for this reason or that reason. There is an opportunity in Illinois. It's one of the few bright spots in that godforsaken, formerly land of Lincoln, soon to be. EmpowerIllinois.org, up to $13,000 per kid per year. And I know there's not enough money in that fund for all the demand. So if you're on the other side and you can be a donor and take the tax credit benefit from being a donor, 75 cents on the dollar, then you should do that too, so that Mike and people like him can get their kids on lifeboats and out of these school systems and to better schools with better outcomes. That is a great long-term investment, or it's a great short-term contribution, which turns into a long-term investment in civilization, or the restarting of civilization in a place like Chicago. Thanks, Mike. Will and Skokie.
Good morning. Now, we all know in Illinois that the reason the Democrats keep winning is primarily because the largest employer in Illinois is the government. And government workers are unionized. And unionized workers vote. They can be organized very easily to vote. And they do this so they can keep this pension thing in Illinois where pensions are guaranteed. If they have the highest, we could default on everything else, but we still have to pay pensions according to the Constitution. Now, this is what's happening with the federal government. They're trying to push it up to the feds, so they can assure that the Democrats always win the elections, because they're going to have, again, more public employee unions. We'll get to the point eventually where most people will be employed by the government, and therefore the government will always win, or at least the Democratic government will always win.
Well, that's a pretty good summation. And, oh, by the way, Illinois, I believe, is the only state in the Midwest. Maybe Ohio still is, too, but certainly we have a lead over them. More government employees than employees in the manufacturing sector. The latter is a wealth-creating sector. The former is not. And as to one other little provision in the $1.9 trillion in proposed funny money spend, it includes, Andy Biggs had a good piece on this in the Journal the other day, rescuing multi-employer pension plans.
If that
goes through, rescuing underfunded multi-employer pension plans, private sector trade union deals, then you can be sure that's a predicate to rescuing state-level public sector pension funds when some of them, like in Chicago and Illinois, inevitably capsize. Jim in Naperville.
You know, how sexist of you, Amy, because I'm a stay-at-home dad. Not all of us are women staying home, to watch our children. My career suffered during the Obama administration when we started having children. And ever since then, my wife's been making more money than me. So we have to suck it up. And that's the way it goes.
Well, good for you.
But I'm just saying.
Right? No, you're right. Like, I should have said dads too. You're very right. It's true.
And now we gotta really hump it and bust our ass to try and make up to how we gotta pay, because I'm a citizen paying taxes. Now I have to pay for all these guys that are on high payrolls, right?
Yes.
As an individual.
Yes. That's the way it is. That's thanks for the call, Jim. That's the actual program of the Democrat Socialists. It's reverse Robin Hood.
And CPS is going to get $1.5 billion if they sign this COVID relief bill. That's on top of what they've already gotten. What are they doing with that money? Where is that money going to go?
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This installment of The Purge. We start with Dr. Seuss. The company that publishes Dr. Seuss's children's book says it will stop selling 6 of its titles because they contain racist and insensitive images. It's been a while since I've read Dr. Seuss, but the affected titles, maybe for those with young kids at home, you can weigh in on this. The affected titles include If I Ran the Zoo and To Think I Saw It on Mulberry Street, McElligot's Pool, On Beyond Zebra, Scrambled Eggs Super, and The Cat's Quizzer.
What's wrong with these books?
They have racist and or insensitive images. Mm-hmm. A Virginia school district ordered its teachers to avoid linking Read Across America Day with Dr. Seuss because research shows strong racial undertones in many of its books. And what did the publisher do? They genuflected. They bent the knee. Dr. Seuss Enterprise listened and took feedback from our audiences, including teachers, academics, and specialists in the field as part of our review process. That's where they made the mistake. The teachers, the academics, and the specialists in the field. This is a field? What's the field? Race hustling? We then worked with a panel of experts. There's where they made the second mistake, including educators, to review our catalog of titles. The result? Purge. Six books gone. Maybe that doesn't mean much to you because your kids are past that age, because Dr. Seuss oeuvre has receded into the background of relevance to you as an adult. But, of course, it's just indicative of what's going on, generally speaking. And you can say, it doesn't affect me, it doesn't affect me, it doesn't affect me, and watch this roll forward, and ultimately it will affect you. Dr. Seuss.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Here's a little bit more salient example of the purge that's ongoing. These are not one-offs anymore. And there's a good survey research, a piece called Academic Freedom is Withering in the Wall Street Journal by Andrew by Birkbeck College political science professor, talking about how pervasive the attitudes are in higher ed in the West, and of course how that necessarily impacts the sort of intellectual climate that is present on college campuses. So to that end, guest op-ed that Barry Weiss, formerly of the New York Times, posted at her page at Substack, from a Romanian-born math professor at Princeton University. He has just come to realize what's happening. Sergey Kleinerman. In my position as a professor of math at Princeton, I've witnessed the decline of universities and cultural institutions as they've embraced political ideology at the expense of rigorous scholarship. Until recently, this past summer, I had naively thought that the STEM disciplines would be spared from this ideological takeover. All that's been going on for so many years, and here you have a math professor at Princeton. Well, he's probably focused on math and teaching math, so I guess it's somewhat understandable, but it's hard to believe he didn't see what was going on around him for so long, particularly in the Ivy League. Anyway, until recently, he thought that STEM disciplines would be spared from the ideological takeover. I was wrong, Princeton math professor from Romania. You'd think he would have a heightened sensitivity to it since he grew up under Ceausescu's communism. Attempts to deconstruct math, deny its objectivity, accuse it of racial bias, and infuse it with political ideology have become more and more common, perhaps even at your child's elementary school. Does that matter? Your child is learning ethno-mathematics, not white math. What's the difference? Stay tuned. Unlike the traditional totalitarianism practiced by former communist countries like the Romania I grew up in, writes the professor, this version is soft. It enforces its ideology not by jailing dissenters or physically eliminating them, but by social shaming, mob punishment, guilt by association, and coerced speech. When it comes to education, I believe the woke ideology is even more harmful than old-fashioned communism. You see, communism had a strong sense of objective reality anchored in the belief that humans are capable of discovering universal truths. It forcefully asserted, in fact, the absolute truth of dialectical materialism, as revealed by its founders, Marx, Engels, Lenin, with a little help from Hegel. Communist ideology held science and math in the highest regard, even though it often distorted the former for doctrinal reasons. Math was largely immune to ideological pressure and thus thrived in most communist countries. Being skilled in math was a source of great societal prestige for school children, and it was a great equalizer. Those from socioeconomically disadvantaged families had a chance to compete on equal footing with those from privileged ones. Like children all over the world, I was attracted to math because of its formal beauty, the elegance, the precision of its arguments, and the unique sense of achievement I was able to get by finding the right answer to a difficult problem. The woke ideology, on the other hand, treats both science and math as social constructs, condemns the way they're practiced in research and teaching, and manifestations as manifestations of white supremacy, Eurocentrism, and post-colonialism. There's a program, Pathway to Equitable Math Instruction, that's backed by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. There they are again.
Yep. Dr. Gates, you know, who said we need three vaccinations.
He argues that white supremacy culture shows up in the classroom when the focus is on getting the right answer, or when students are required to show their work while stipulating that the very concept of mathematics being purely objective is unequivocally false. The main goal of the program is to dismantle racism in mathematics instruction with the expressly political aim of engaging the socio-political turn in all aspects of education, including math. In the past, the professor writes, I would have found such statements, even underwritten by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as absurd, as anomalous. I can't anymore. They're too numerous. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Math will be felled by politics in some quarters, not every. And where do you think that's going to leave your kids when this passes? It may be a lot. There may be a lot of ugliness and a good deal of time before this passes. But ultimately, like all totalitarian ideologies, it will fall under its own weight. And how will you be recorded as having responded as it seeped into every corner of America?
And the how do you think warned that this was going to happen?
How do you think your how do you think your children will fare when they learn ethnocentrist math rather than math?
Ethnocentrist.
John McWhorter, if you don't know him, you should get to know him. He's a linguist at Columbia University. We've mentioned him before. He's taken up this as well. He's a black gentleman. Is it racist to expect black kids to do math for real? Yes, serious people are arguing this. Make sure they don't infect your school district. He cites another document in circulation, Dismantling Racism in Mathematics Instruction. The idea is to show how our racial reckoning of late ought to change how we expose black kids to math. I suppose the council is also intended for kids of other types of melanin, but this is, in essence, a document that could be called Math for Black Kids. This is the latest in the state level. This latest is the state level policymakers in Oregon are especially intrigued by this document. Mm-hmm. He goes on to just tackle this. One idea is that black students learn how math has hurt people, i.e. black ones. But it's no slam dunk that little kids need to be taught this. Wouldn't this affect a child's attitude toward mastering the skills? The burden is upon the authors of this document to explain just why it would not. Sure, teachers imparting this lesson would show that they know racism exists. Thus, they will reckon with racism, as we are told they must. But what might the impact of the lesson be on children who haven't even reached puberty? More to the point, the entire document is focused on the idea that making black kids be precise is immoral. The document pays lip service otherwise, claiming at one point to teach rich, thoughtful, complex math, and rather often the word praxis is used, but the thrust of the pamphlet is that a focus on getting the right answer is perfectionism and wrong. The idea that teachers are teachers and students are learners is wrong. To think of it as a problem that the expectations you have of students are not met is racist. To teach math in a linear fashion with skills taught in sequence is racist. To require students to show their work is racist. Requiring students to raise their hand before speaking can reinforce paternalism and power hoarding in addition to breaking the process of thinking, learning, and communicating. He writes of this in some. You may wonder if this is a cartoon, but no, this is real. This is actually what this document tells us again and again. To distrust this document is not to be against social justice, but against racism. A Romanian math professor at Princeton, black American linguist professor at Columbia University. Unfortunately, John McWhorter and the math prof at Princeton are the one-offs in academia today. They're the anomalies.
So,
and you should be very, very frightened if you have kids anywhere in the pre-K through pro-secondary education system in this country. And you should be very, very, what's the word, precise with their education. I can't stress it enough.
So it's a collective approach to dismantle white supremacy through math? I'm
Carol,
trying to wrap my head around this one.
Carol in Moments, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Well, good morning. I guess if I were a black parent, I would be so totally, totally insulted that stupid is good, and that my children were unable to learn these concepts of math and science.
Yes, it's patronizing to blacks, which is McWhorter's point, but it's this is not limited in its scope. I mean, it's not just black kids in the classroom. So this is ideological in nature.
It's going to affect everybody, but it's like eventually you're going to end up with this one little elite group that's just going to make slaves out of everybody.
Correct. Thanks for the call, Carol. There's somebody who's getting it. Tim in Woodstock.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, I think there are some leftists who pander to minorities for political votes, but on the other hand, I think that the true white supremacy exists. A good example is somebody like Bill Gates, who I think there's whites who really do believe that they're superior, and that the minority communities, you know, blacks, Hispanics, they can't figure out things for themselves. They can't compete on a level playing field, and they have the answers for them. And I think it almost becomes a type of religion for these people. Their souls are so vacuous that then helping these people that they see as inferior becomes like a mission for them in life. And I think that's part of what's going on in Bill Gates' head, really.
Thanks for the call, Tim. There's no doubt there's a supremacist or even messianic aspect to the expert class. And it transcends race, but it certainly includes that.
They have money, so they think that they're so smart. And then they use their money for power.
Mark in Plainfield.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I have two wise cracks that will hopefully bring a smile to Dan's face.
Yes.
First, will Mathis racist work with the IRS when I accidentally miscalculate my tax return? And two, if you don't believe Mathis racist, explain the fraction 3/5.
Okay, Mark, thanks for that. Those home-cooked math jokes. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I don't know if this is going to get Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger back in good standing with President Trump, but it is worth noting the state of Georgia has advanced, and legislative Republicans have advanced substantial election reforms in a party line vote. This happened yesterday afternoon. This is just a few of the topic areas. Absentee ballots. Under the proposal that is moving to Brian Kemp's desk, voters must include their Georgia driver's license or ID number or a photocopy of another government-issued document in order to request an absentee ballot. This would do away with the signature match requirement because you'd have to include a copy of your ID or the identifying number.
All right, that's good news.
Shortens the window for Georgians to request an absentee ballot from 180 days prior to the election to 78. Cuts it in, you know, more than half.
Yeah, but that's still too long. But all right, what else?
It's 3 months to submit an absentee ballot, right, application or request for an absentee ballot. So you need to have some give for turnaround time. But obviously 80 days is more than enough give. request absentee ballots 78 days in advance. The deadline to submit an application is 11 days before the election. So that's pretty substantial. That means we're going to make sure that all the absentee ballots that are to be counted are in possession by Election Day, is essentially what that's doing. The bill prohibits counties and states from sending out unsolicited absentee ballot applications as they did ahead of the 2020 primaries.
And that happened in Illinois, too. If you're a registered Democrat in certain cities, they would, or counties, too, they would send you an absentee ballot.
Well, right. Illinois is beyond hope. Okay. We still have hope for Georgia. And
all right, let's focus where there's hope. Fine.
any outside groups that send absentee ballot applications to voters must include a disclaimer that the application is not a ballot. Counties would be required to have at least one absentee ballot drop box, but cannot have more than one box per 100,000 active registered voters, or the number of advanced voting locations in the county, which ever is less. In other words, you can't have the Zucker boxes, you know, every 6 feet.
Yeah, like Starbucks.
Also, those drop boxes would have to be at the county elections office or an inside advanced voting location, would only be open during early voting hours, so they would be under constant surveillance.
Good.
Election workers would be able to begin opening and scanning absentee ballots about 2 weeks before Election Day. They would not, however, be allowed to tabulate them until 7 a.m. on the day of the election or primary. Overseas military ballots, in order to avoid the 9-week runoff Georgians experienced for the state's two U.S. Senate seats, ranked choice voting for those in the military or voting overseas. So citizens overseas, military would have ranked choice voting with respect to the runoff elections. Also, change the advance voting period. Early voting would still begin about 3 weeks before Election Day, but the hours would be set by the state 9 to 5. Bill also limits weekend voting to just the second Saturday before the election and then either the third Saturday or third Sunday. Legislation bans the use of mobile voting precincts except in emergencies declared by the governor. Provisional ballots. Provisional ballots would be a thing of the past. Anyone who shows up at the wrong precinct at present on Election Day can ask to cast a provisional ballot. That means the voter will likely end up with races on their ballot for which they're not qualified to vote. The House bill in question here would require they toss out the ballot in its entirety. The legislation requires ballots to be printed on security paper so they can be identified as valid. Also bans counties from accepting grants or any other outside funding to run their elections, like many did in 2020, as I just mentioned, Zucker boxes. Strips the Secretary of State of some of his power. Rather than serving as chair of the state election board, he would instead be a non-voting member, he or she. The legislature would choose their own chair to head up the state election board. So that's, it's a lot of detail, but, I mean, we went through all these details and all these states that were in question after the November 3rd election for good reason. And this is, I think, pretty substantial in the direction of reforming the way that Georgia ran its elections for the purposes of inspiring more confidence in Georgia's administration of the elections. It'll be interesting to see if Trump decides to weigh in on these reform measures, but these are important reforms. And by the way, on that topic, there, the Supreme Court, this is one of the reasons Supreme Court justices are so important, right, the balance of power in the Supreme Court, because they extend beyond the president who nominates them, usually. And so there's an important case before the Supreme Court with respect to Arizona election law. In a case of Brnovich v. DNC, Brnovich is the attorney general in the state of Arizona. As the Wall Street Journal opines, this offers the court an opportunity to restore the Voting Rights Act to its original purpose. At issue is Arizona's requirement that voters cast ballots on Election Day in their assigned precinct and its ban on ballot harvesting by outside groups.
I love that idea.
Democrats are challenging this, saying it violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And, of course, the state of Arizona is defending that. So that's not anything that's new. It's not new reforms being advanced, but it's a defense of some smart provisions in Arizona election law as it pertains to the administration of their elections. I mean, this is something that was central to President Trump's remarks at CPAC on Sunday evening, where he reiterated his view that the election was rigged, but he transitioned quickly to call for, you know, we need a single election day, not 35, 40
or 80 days. I mean, the longer election goes on, the more vulnerable it becomes.
And he had other proposals to, you know, voter ID, signature match, eliminate the mass mail out of absentee ballots. Have a substantive reason in order to vote absentee, not just because you feel like it. And that's all fine. But I think what you have that exists in Arizona right now, what you have proposed in Georgia, particularly the Georgia example, is consistent with sort of the broad strokes that former President Trump painted on Sunday night. So that's good news, at least in one of those states that you know the Democrats are not going to just turn away from after having picked it off in 2020. Because why? Well, because they have two Democrat senators now, Democrat socialist senators, and one of those, Warnock, is up in 2022. His reelection could very well determine
the power control
of the United States Senate.
Yep.
And so if you want the House back, which I think there's a very good chance to happen, and with Warnock as potentially a linchpin for control of the Senate, that presents a very good chance for Republicans too. And then you stop all that we're seeing over the last, well, not all, you stop a lot of what we're seeing and what is being proposed over the last 5 weeks for the last 2 years of the Biden-Harris administration. So it's a big deal. And it's nice to see Republicans in the state of Georgia responding.
Taking it seriously. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what, any word on those 1,700 Georgians who voted twice by mail and in person? No, because they haven't been arrested.
It's past post, right.
But still, they should have set an example by doing something to those people who thought, you know, oh, we'll just sneak it in. They won't know. They should have done something to them to show that, hey, when you commit fraud, there's consequences.
Well, and then there are cases. The Heritage database is always being updated. Hans von Spakovsky, our friend, has recently written about a case in Michigan. Michigan resident Paul Parana pleading guilty to one count of impersonating someone else to vote in an election. He filled out and signed an absentee ballot on behalf of his daughter, sentenced to 90 days probation in order to pay $1,100 in fines and court costs. So I mean, doesn't mean he's some dumb operative or something. But again, Paul Parana voting for himself and voting for his daughter illegitimately disenfranchises somebody's vote. And it's always the question, oh, it's no big deal. It's not determinative. So is it okay if we disenfranchise your vote? Is it okay if we eliminate your vote? The dismissive attitude to voter fraud by those who largely benefit from voter fraud, I guess I think I've just explained why they have a dismissive
Great.
Attitude. Paul in Plainfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
So, Dan, this is a wonderful hearing these reforms going on in Georgia, but what are we doing about the state judicial systems that will just completely ignore these laws come election time when it benefits Democrats, like what happened in Pennsylvania and throughout the nation, right? I think that's the second half that we have to worry about and we have to work on, because all of these laws will just be ignored by the judicial branch.
Well, thanks for the call, Paul. I mean, there again, there's a balance of power issue, right? And that third co-equal branch of government. So the Pennsylvania Supreme Court did exactly what you're describing, Paul. But obviously you had courts in other states that didn't intercede. But you did have administrative agencies like the Secretary of State's office in Georgia that did. And so you're right. The dynamics are going to be very different in each state. But you have to start with the lawmaking body and getting the executive on board. And in states where you have Republican control of the state legislature, as well as a Republican executive like the state of Georgia, you would hope to see the sort of substantial changes that you're seeing afoot in Georgia. And even if you have a Democrat executive, you still hope and expect to see Republican-controlled legislatures in places like Wisconsin move as well to address the particular issue there. Again, every state is a bit unique, the dynamics as well as the issues. What was the big issue in Wisconsin, as far as I'm concerned? The unique issue in Wisconsin, which was substantial, this sort of indisposed voter designation that was extended to virtually anyone who was afraid to go out their front door because of COVID. You know, that indisposed voter designation, I think I'm using the wrong phraseology, but that's effectively what it is. That indisposed voter designation, that needs to be addressed by Republicans in Madison, as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, and we'll continue to update, because just as we discussed this when it came to trying to understand what happened in each of these states that was so impactful, we're going to have to discuss the specifics of what the response is from Republicans in particular in those same states. Bruce in Milwaukee.
Oh, Pat, thanks for taking my call. As a follow-up to what you're talking about, this recent ruling down in Arizona where the judge ruled that the Maricopa County has to turn over, I believe it was 2.1 million ballots and the machines provided, I'm kind of interested to see what happens, even if they only find 2,000 or 3,000, you know, votes of P.O. Box addresses or vacant lot addresses or dead people. I think that would still be an indication that there's a problem out there.
Thanks for the call. Bruce, appreciate it. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, Dan and Amy, good morning. This is the most important case, Dan, I think. And most of these state legislatures, I believe, are Article 2 protected, that the state legislature is the one to lay out what election law is. And earlier, Mike Scott had reported on they're already protesting, saying this is racist. It has to be stood up to. The idea that somehow it's racist for someone to have an identification card, someone just needs to ask these people why. Why is that?
Well,
you can do almost anything in this country.
Thanks for the call. Everything is racist. Everything I disagree. That's just a synonymous with saying I disagree when you're talking about that reaction from the leftists. I mean, the voter ID, they have no problem with voter ID, at least not that I've heard, when it comes to vaccine distribution, but they have a problem with voter ID with respect to voting. They have no problem with voter ID when it comes to accessing government transfer benefits, but they have a problem when it comes to voting. I mean, it's they don't have a substantive, credible position. They just wanted it to be as freewheeling as it was November 3rd. They've always wanted what happened in 2020, and in 2020 they got it. Sean in Elmwood Park.
This is so ridiculous, and it is such an example of once your standards are shattered and your faith is crushed, anything looks like an improvement. This is like me telling my wife, I won't pick up two hairdressers at a time anymore, honey. I swear it's going to be better. Are you out of your mind? Fix the damn voting. Fix it. I want proof. I want fingerprints. I want blockchain. I want unequivocal answers. I want no slippage. Who the hell do these scumbags think they are as they solidify their corruption with a frauded voter system? No more. And as for the Democrats, you want these scumbags in charge? You go stand in the corner with them, you scum. I can't stand a lot of it anymore. And I'll never waste a day. That's why those are waves in the background. This is what I'm going to do on Election Day. Same thing I'm doing during the morning show.
Okay, Sean. Sean, who's abdicated from participating in elections. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Mike Manapkin runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
Dan and Amy, and that means it's time for our weekly hit with Ted Dabrowski, the president of Wirepoints, Inc., wirepoints.com. And Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Morning. So I was reading about the budget proposals of certain Dem Socialist Midwest governors like Evers in Wisconsin and Jelly Belly here in Illinois and Wolf in Pennsylvania. It's interesting. They all have something in common, the budgets, that is. They all propose to increase taxes in various ways, and they all propose to reduce school choice in various ways.
Well, that's the common theme across many of the states like these. They're looking for federal money to balance their budgets, and they're using their power to reduce school choice. And let's see if they're successful. They certainly want to do that in Illinois. And we've had, I think, the only good school choice program we've had ever in Illinois, and they're trying to reduce that. But that's part of the game.
And with respect to the tax credit scholarship program, Pritzker's proposal is to reduce the credit down from 75% to 40%, which would effectively neuter the program. And that's really what this is. This isn't a cost-saving measure to get money in the coffers. This is a sop to the teachers' union, isn't it?
Well, it sure is. I mean, they never wanted this plan in the first place. If this is probably the few of the good things that that Rauner did. He got this credit scholarship program in there, they probably shoot themselves in the for having allowed that. But now they can try to get rid of it, and that's exactly what Pritzker and others will do. And if they can't do it all now, they'll certainly try over the next few years.
So you think if he's reelected that the credit scholarship program is going to go away?
Well, the unions hate it, right? I mean, that's competition for the schools, and you've seen school choice across the country blossom. You've got at least 26 states that have some form of school choice. And, if COVID has taught us anything, and I think this is one of the huge lessons, is that the unions don't care about keeping schools open. It showed us that what they care about is themselves. And so school choice is really the next real alternative. And let's see what kind of drive we get for school choice. But it's going to be a battle. I think it should be a battle. But, Governor Pritzker and others will certainly try to kill school choice here in Illinois.
Yeah, and those school choice families, those recipients of the tax credit scholarships, time to get activated. And activate those in your social circles, the schools, the private schools across faiths as well as non-sectarian schools. Time to get activated if you want this opportunity for kids and the opportunity that it presents for you to educate more kids. Time to get activated on that. Now on the tax front, Jelly Belly not proposing to increase the state's flat income tax, like his buddy Tom Wolf in Pennsylvania is. He's doing the old sort of take from your back pocket what I can't get from your front pocket. He's a bunch of other smaller tax and fee increases as the means to cobble together another phony baloney balance budget.
Well, yeah, that's why he's looking at this $1 billion worth of what he calls corporate tax loopholes. To figure things out. Of course, there has to be legislation to roll back what he calls the loopholes. But what we all know is that a loophole to one group is a tax hike on another group. So Pritzker wants to find ways to do it. He's going to find ways to do it quietly. I think the big story for this year will be that Pritzker managed to, this is how he's going to spin it. He's managed to save Illinois without having to do an income tax hike. We know it's because of the federal money that will be coming in. And, 2022, campaign season starts, and he doesn't want to, I don't think, have a big tax hike on there, so he'll do all kinds of the small ones that we're so good at in Illinois, just the nickel and dime. But that's probably the strategy, and, he'll say that he kept things together, and here we go. We're back, and Illinois is back on track. You're already starting to hear some of that in the press.
Yeah.
And that's sad because it kind of hides the real problems that we continue to have that I think only a federal bailout and all this federal borrowing has hidden.
So, Ted Dabrowski, if this passes through the Senate today, this COVID relief, take three or four, I don't even know what number we're on, how much money is going to be sent to Illinois, and will that be used for pension reform?
Well, so it won't be used for pension reform, I can tell you that.
Not
but,
reform, but to pay the, I'm sorry.
Sure.
To pay the pensions.
Even for that, right? So, they're talking about $350 billion for states, of which The current negotiations, we don't know until it's final, will be about $14 billion for Illinois, and 7.5 of that will go to the state. So, you know, the state has to pay back the federal government for the money it borrowed already, close to $2 billion, more than $2 billion, I should say. It's got a whole bunch of unpaid bills. It's got some COVID expenses. So really, that'll just kind of cover the holes and make Pritzker say that he balanced the budget in 2021. He'll have a little bit of flexibility because of that in 2022. And, you know, there won't be money left for pensions. Yeah, nothing will go there. So he'll just claim that he paid the statutory amount and everything's balanced. And there we go. Everybody's happy again.
Also, too, I mean, there's been a good deal of reporting that the hit to state coffers from the pandemic wasn't nearly as severe as anticipated in most places. And we've actually seen household income climb over the last year because of all of the propping up of said household income by federal largesse.
Yeah, at Wire Points, we gathered all the 50 state data and looked at all the original projections of how much all the states were going to lose, right? And they were all, at the beginning of the pandemic, had these extremely dire projections of how much they would lose, which of course fed into the whole thing of let's get more money back into the states. And so we added all that up and we looked at the most recent numbers that have been released for calendar year 2020. And what you find is that states largely came out of this, some came out ahead, but on average about break even with 2019. So despite the dire projections, things have turned out much better. A big part of that, of course, has been the trillions of dollars that have been thrown to people to spend. And so you've seen sales tax revenue survive. You've seen capital gains for the stock market up survive. And therefore, states don't need the money anymore. They've got enough money in their coffers. What we need to do is get back to opening up the economy and grow that way rather than keep printing money and giving it to people.
Speaking of COVID, my dad, who's 77 years old, can't seem to get scheduled for a vaccine, and it's not because he's not computer literate. He's waiting for an opening to get an appointment to get vaccinated, get the COVID vaccine. A caller yesterday had a story of her 83-year-old father also having trouble getting an appointment. It's anecdotal, but we're hearing a lot of these stories. And we also find that R. Kelly and some of his fellow inmates have been vaccinated, have already gotten both shots of the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine. How are we doing on vaccine distribution here in Illinois based on vulnerability?
Well, we know, and it's just undeniable, right, that the people who die from this COVID are those people 60 and older. 90% of the people who died in Illinois are 60 or older. 90%. So we know who needs the vaccine, and yet if you go to IDPH and look at their numbers today, you'll see that we've provided 2.5 million doses of the vaccine, and 1.7 of those, 1.5 million of those have gone to people ages 18 to 64. In other words, more than half is going to the young people. Mm-hmm. Less than half is going to the people who die. It just makes no sense.
Right. But in some professions, like, you know, I coach, so they told me, well, you've got to get a vaccine. I said, well, is it mandatory? And she said, I can't tell you to take it, but it would be, you know, beneficial for you if you got the vaccine. So I took the vaccine, but I felt guilty the whole time taking it. Dan, I think I have a way to help your dad, by the way, so we'll talk after the show if you're interested. But it's, you know, we hand it out on profession rather than age. And when you look at someplace like Florida, who did it right, they focus on the elderly first. And in nursing homes, remember DeSantis was there too when the vaccinations were being administered at nursing homes. And I don't know if we did that in Illinois, do you?
Well, we did. I mean, we put them in the priority, but if you look at the numbers, right, we still haven't made it work. That's what's most frustrating about this is that we continue to put teachers. So you hear about all kinds of school districts vaccinating teachers, and that's really sad because every time you're vaccinating a 25-year-old teacher, somebody else could be dying at that moment, right? And that's not an exaggeration. And then you hear the story of Lori Lightfoot opening up some of these places in southern Chicago, South Chicago, where they are vaccinating anybody of any age in those communities. And you don't even have to sign up. As long as you're from that community, you can come in and get a vaccine. And, you know, they're trying to do that in the name of equity, but while they're doing that, elderly black people are going to die because they're giving the vaccines to the wrong people. It's that simple.
Mm-hmm. And with respect to the General Assembly, do we still have one in Illinois? Because I everything that we talk about with respect to state policy, whether it's fiscal policy or COVID policy, it's just it all goes back to the governor's office. I remember once upon a time when we used to have a General Assembly that was part of this conversation.
You mean like they used to make a few decisions and actually vote on things?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. I remember that. Well, do you remember that?
Yeah, when that place called Springfield they used to gather in,
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you look at the numbers now, that's something that doesn't get any attention. But how the heck, you know, why hasn't the legislature stripped Governor Pritzker of his executive order powers? You know, this is the 12-month in. The numbers are collapsing, right? If you look at the COVID numbers, they're collapsing, in of course, in a great way. Deaths are down, cases are down, hospitalizations are down, you know, 70-80% from those peaks. And yet you don't hear anything about, one, Pritzker giving up those, you know, rights, or somebody trying to take them away. So they're happy. I guess they're all happy letting Pritzker own this, and Pritzker will probably celebrate what a great job he did, despite the fact that we're the 14th or 16th worst in the country in deaths per capita. So it's a really screwy situation, and you know, I don't think we can have a state if we don't have a legislature that actually runs it.
One other topic that we continue to bat around here, and I think some people are FOIAing this information, but you know that requires compliance, much as it did in New York State. What exactly Pritzker did or didn't order with respect to infected nursing home patients being returned to nursing homes? That's been real gooey, his answers over the many months, and it seems hard to get data. They certainly don't promulgate any data. And just as people are starting to now ask those same uncomfortable questions about the Eva Peron of East Lansing up there in Michigan, shouldn't we be asking those of Pritzker?
Yeah, you know, that's something at WirePoints that we did. You know, we compiled daily data on COVID and put it up on our website. And one of the struggles we always had was to understand the retirement home deaths. And, of course, as we all know, they you know, rose up to 50% at its peak of all deaths, assuming that that's the true number. But nobody could ever really get the full story on what Pritzker ordered and didn't order. And I don't think that, you know, as we know, our investigative prowess in Illinois for this kind of stuff hasn't been great. And I don't think the press, I mean, I know Amy's done a great job of actually trying to ask some of these things, but overall, nobody's dug in there to find out what happened. But, you know, we've seen it. I mean, if you look at the numbers, it is a sad situation, not just for retirement homes, but for the elderly. We don't have enough questions asked here. We certainly don't have enough answers.
Yeah, well, in regards to the VA hospital, I remember Pritzker saying, well, some of the staff members were infected and brought it in. And I thought, really, which staff members? But that's,
right.
I mean, we had 36 veterans die at LaSalle County Veterans Home. So somebody has blood on their hands.
Well, you know, Amy, you bring that up, and that's something that I think I get really angry about, is that, you know, they put a lot of attention, as they should, when the LaSalle death started happening. But, you know, that same thing that played out in LaSalle was happening all over the state, right, and mm-hmm. in hundreds of homes. And, you know, why didn't they have the same urgency when it was just normal retirement homes? It's fascinating, and I'm glad they paid attention to the veterans, as they should. But it's the same attention that you should get for you know these nursing homes that you have, you know, tens of cases and tens of deaths in a single home. Why didn't they get the same attention?
Ted Dabrowski, president at WirePoints, wirepoints.org is the website. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Have you seen this now on the market? For the kids, Fisher Price My Home Office, $24.99, comes with a fake laptop, a fake cup of coffee, fake
I hope
headset.
It's a Starbucks.
Better grab a latte to go. The report is due in the morning, and there's a call with a dog across the street after nap time. With the Fisher Price My Home Office set, your preschooler is the boss of their own workstation at home. the local coffee shop, or the moon. This eight-piece pretend playset includes pretend laptop, four fabric apps to attach to the computer screen, a wood smartphone, and headset for all those important business calls, and a to-go cup for kids to sip their favorite beverage. Urgent call from the cat. The busy business requires immediate attention. Sign of the times. That's going to be post-pandemic living. It's sort of fun, I guess. I don't know. I don't know if you want to wean your kids on that Fisher-Price toy particularly. But
Does it come with a Mr. or Mrs. Potato Head?
No, and nor does it come with any Dr. Seuss books. Oh, by the way, just on the banning of a half a dozen Dr. Seuss books.
Well, yeah, and not publishing. They're not even going to make them or create them anymore.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Well, you don't even have a choice now.
Attendant. Ted Geisel, Dr. Seuss, mm-hmm. he wrote and illustrated more than 60 books. So six have insensitive imagery. Well, they were all done by the same guy.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So now he needs to be cancel cultured. It's a verb now.
All his books have to go. He has to be expelled from the California Hall of Fame. His statues in his honor and so forth have to be taken down, right? I mean, are we serious about these Dr. Seuss books, or are we not? We can't be half serious about something as serious as this, can we? So he's got to go altogether. Needs to be erased from our memory banks, as does all his work. Good work. Doesn't it? Be nice if people would take the Jacobins to their logical conclusion rather than just sort of pass this over as yet another example and isn't this ridiculous, and then we move on to the next example and say isn't this ridiculous and so on and so forth. You know, isn't this ridiculous that my kids' school won't teach Shakespeare because they think it promotes toxic masculinity and white supremacy? That's real. Isn't that ridiculous? Okay, well then just Shakespeare should be eliminated altogether, shouldn't he? All his work, his existence. Yeah.
And back to Dr. Seuss, I mean, this one voice in a Virginia school district, one person was angry, and now they're not going to publish six Dr. Seuss books. Think about that.
Going back to the Fisher-Price, and let people think about that. I don't know. I don't know what to think about it other than to say, shouldn't you challenge people to expose the illogic in addition to illiberalism of their position? I don't know. But the Fisher-Price set called to mind this Tyler Cohen op-ed in Bloomberg. We talk so much about all the negatives with respect to the lockdowns and pandemic existence. Is there anything you'll miss about your pandemic existence? He writes, and he's talking about small personal changes. He's not talking about, like, I will miss my kids not going to school, of course. That's right. He's talking about little things. Or working from home even. He said, I'm referring to habits and routines we developed as individuals. For example, I for one will miss the Saturday evening Zoom meeting. Since the pandemic started, I found it easy to schedule calls at 5:30 or 6:30, even when more than one person is involved. Everyone just says, yes, why not? You're not going out to the movies or dinner. Even if you think Zoom calls are oppressive, especially if you think Zoom calls are oppressive, it's better to have somewhere to put your marginal Zoom call other than 2 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon. He said, I'll also miss early lunch. Like a lot of people, I miss eating in a variety of settings, not just restaurants or coffee shops or cafeterias or even my desk. So I look for the variety temporally. The early cooking of a hamburger does indeed provide that break in the routine. Why do I need breakfast anyway? Have I mentioned, like many Americans, I've been sleeping longer during the pandemic?
No.
In my case, it's only about 15 minutes longer, but it's enough reason to accelerate lunch and minimize breakfast. Restaurant norms are yet another reason for the 11 a.m. lunch. Meanwhile, I'm accumulating messes of various kinds and sizes. I no longer clean out my car.
Me
I hesitate.
Either.
Yeah, right.
I have not cleaned my car since this started.
Well, he writes, other than immediate family, who's writing with me anyway?
Right.
Yeah, so the question is, is his experience unique? Some of these little things that he's noticed that he maybe will miss once human interaction is sanctioned in states where it's not currently. He asks, is my experience unique, or once the pandemic is over, might we all move to laxer norms of dress and orderliness? It could be like one of those companies where senior management stops wearing ties and the rest of the office follows suit.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. What are you going to miss, Dan? Anything?
I got to say, for me, I'm not exactly sure how much my life has changed, other than going to restaurants, going to shows.
Right. And the opera. You used to go to the opera.
Well, shows, yeah. Going to sporting events, some sporting events, although that was less and less so because of the politicization of sports. Attending a few things. But in terms of sort of my, like, everyday life, I'm not going to manufacture something. I guess I just haven't been that impacted.
Oh, my God. You're so lucky.
Nah.
I mean, you're blessed. You are so blessed. For those of us who have kids, this has just been a game changer. And
well,
especially student-athletes.
Well, stop bitching. What are you going to be? What are you going to be whimsical? What are you going to be forlorn that you miss? What are things that you like right now?
I don't like anything. I like coming to work. I like
that before.
Right, you're right. Well, I was off for 3 months. I was, scared of COVID. I got sucked into the drama.
That's one of the things you'll miss is working remotely.
I guess so. There's not a lot to look forward to. But I mean, now we have sports coming, so
that's a bigger thing though. That's like, what about, like, think of little things, like instead of going out to restaurants, you've turned your eldest son Peyton into your personal chef.
There you go.
That's a positive development.
That's a positive.
That's the kind of thing he's talking about.
Thank you, Dr. Proft.
Yeah.
But I keep thinking of this. Just listen to this third grader.
Why aren't you more, you need to be more optimistic. You need to look on the sunny side of life like I do.
You're telling me to be optimistic.
Yeah. Stop being such a downer all the time.
Yeah, I'm a downer.
Just be happy-go-lucky like me.
I wish, I just can't look out my window because I see people just lobotomized wearing 3 masks now, Dan. 3.
Yeah, well.
I sat next to a man at the scorer's table. I'm not going to say his name yesterday because I was in charge of the clock and he was doing the books. He had 3 masks on. I couldn't understand for 2 games. I couldn't understand a word he was saying. I'm like, God, you're such a COVID enthusiast. What do you have any comorbidities? Or he's like, I don't understand you, sir. He couldn't find a vaccine, so I helped him find a vaccine location site. So maybe he could calm down and live.
All right, maybe you can up Charlotte in Arlington Heights. Charlotte, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Amy. Where can older seniors get a vaccine in the Northwest suburbs?
All right, you ready? I want you to take down this number.
No, I...
Do you have a pen and paper? Because this is the number to call.
Sure. And what is the number? Is it Cook County Suburban
this is
Department
Cook
of
County,
Health?
But at this point in time, they have vaccines on the shelves. They need to get them off the shelves.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding. Right. Ready? 833-308-1988. Again, 833-308-1988. When you call, it's going to be busy. Keep calling. Press it on redial. Eventually, you'll get in. Tell him you're 1B or 1A, even if you care for another elderly person, you're considered 1A. They don't ask for proof. They don't. They just need your driver's license or if you have a passport.
To go to Tinley Park?
No, there's different locations. You might be sent to Tinley Park. You might go to Triton College. There's various locations. You might go to Arlington Heights. Who knows?
Charlotte, you're going to be whisked away to some gulag, so it was nice knowing you.
Keep calling back, and they're open. I suggest starting to call at 5 to 7. Every morning. They're open from 7 to 7. And keep calling back if they say they don't have we don't have an appointment today. Keep calling back the next day and the next day, and you will get in, I promise.
Now, this is Cook County?
Yes.
What? Cook County what?
Cook County, Illinois, if you live anywhere in Cook County.
No, what's the facility?
There's different facilities. They might send you to Triton. They might send you to Tinley Park. They might send you to Arlington Heights. They might.
But is it at the health department? Is it suburban?
Phone number that you're calling?
Yeah. What exactly is it? What agency? What part of this?
It's Cook County Health Department. It's for scheduling a vaccine. 833-308-1988.
Yeah. They've got
everybody I know has been calling every number, been on the computer every morning, very early in the morning, and you just can't get an appointment. Even with the various drugstores, the pharmacies, it's impossible.
I know. I'm sorry you have to go through that. But don't give up hope. Keep calling that number. Don't every day call, because I got in because somebody had just canceled. And he said, well, where are you? And I said, I'm in my car. And he said, well, get on over here.
Did you tell him you were Amy Jacobson on the radio?
No, I am 1B because I have a CPS card. But no, I did not do that. I don't play those games.
Well, I didn't think you did, but I think Cook County.
Charlotte, yeah. Well, Charlotte, when you call, say, do you know who I know? And then drop Amy Jacobson's name.
See, I'm Charlotte from Arlington Heights.
Thanks, Charlotte. Good luck with getting that appointment scheduled.
And then the United Center opens up March 10th. And not the United Center. They're not seeing people inside. It's the parking lot at the United Center.
There's nothing going on inside.
I know. Those games are so boring.
Rick in Downers Grove.
Hey, how you guys doing? Hey, Amy, with these people with the mask, you can't understand what they're saying. Okay. It's like living in a South Park episode talking to Kenny, but I just tell them, I don't speak mask. You're going to have to write it down or pull the mask off and talk to me like an adult. But here's the thing. I'm like, Dan, this hasn't really affected me at all outside of the fact I can't go to air shows or gun shows. But as far as like money, when the stock market tanked in March of last year, I decided I'm not going to let that opportunity slip by. I bought stuff. It worked out. My company, we kept going. My customers kept going. No social distancing, no mask. I got the PPP money twice, forgiven, and the first one. I mean, it's actually been quite nice.
It's the best thing that ever happened
can't
to you.
Go to air shows.
Good for you, Rick. I mean, honestly, good
yeah,
for
you. Yeah, it's the best thing that's ever happened. And then in the beginning, there was no traffic. It was like, this is like sweet.
Oh, my gosh.
Thanks right, for well, the call, Rick. Yeah. You know, every pandemic makes somebody happy, and somebody is Rick in Downers Grove.
We found him.
Kevin in Libertyville.
I'm using that line, I can't speak mask.
It's more than just Rick, I'm telling you what. This whole pandemic has just been a giant turd. But the one thing that really I'm reticent to see the end of this,
what?
Getting in the left lane, setting the cruise at 87 or 90, and just going. There's no one on the tri-state. And it's just a beautiful thing. It's wide open. My only hope is that so many people have left Illinois or continue to leave Illinois that'll stay this way. But without all these people going into work, that's the only silver lining that I can see.
Yeah, that's a good one. Thanks
and maybe people
call,
might
Kevin.
Not return to work. I mean, who needs an office space? They realize now they can work from home.
Yeah, who needs a job? Just get one of those government jobs.
Yeah.
You don't have to do either.
Get yourself a few kids and you can have 14K. A week, right?
John in Lake Geneva.
Hi, guys. How you doing? I hope you're all well today. I'm on my way south to one of my projects along 31 here, and I must have seen seven or eight. It must be the, I don't know, retirement area of the world or, you know, assisted living area of the world. And heroes work here. Are they still heroes? Banners just all over the place. I'm just passing one right now, ironically.
Yeah.
Heroes work here. Are they heroes?
Yeah. Thanks for the call, John.
They went to work. Well, they're heroes compared to teachers who are still afraid to go to work and veterinarians who are afraid to see customers.
Yeah, that hero word has been stripped of a lot of meaning, hasn't it? Holly in St. Louis.
Well, I'm going to go back to the last half an hour and talk about Dr. Seuss. So 2.5 years ago, my husband and I downsized. We got rid of 7/8 of everything we owned. We have few regrets, but sadly, I got rid of every Dr. Seuss book. We had all of them. We had collections. So this morning, after hearing your show, I jumped on Amazon to see on the secondary market and to think what I saw on Mulberry Street was going for, and it's currently going for about $2,500. So if you have your kids' books at home, Amazon will be happy to peddle it for a huge amount on their site, but you can't buy a new one. It says you try and put it in your cart, and it says your cart is empty. This product is no longer available. So few regrets in the downsizing. Love St. Louis. But really regret giving all of our Dr. Seuss books away to the local charity.
Thanks for the
call.
If
I Ran the Zoo by Dr. Seuss, I have that at home. I'm definitely going to.
Dr. Seuss books is the new Bitcoin. Monica and Lyle.
Hey, I called a few weeks ago. I don't know if you remember me or not, but we were talking about how things are going between your spouses.
Oh, yeah.
For me, okay, well, gee, now that we have all this time on our hands, I have a great sex life. What's going to happen when we have to go back to work normally?
Yeah.
Well, you're going to have to make an appointment. We'll have to
because...
Afternoon delight, huh?
No, after 5 delight.
Okay,
but, yeah.
Monica, sounds great.
Right. Work hard, play hard. Sure.
There you go.
All right, Monica, thanks for the call. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Good op-ed from Frank Mealy at RealClearPolitics.com. Confessions of a Trump Republican. He writes, Trump is not a leader in the traditional sense of inspiring his supporters to believe as he does, but rather someone who gains his strength and power from his ability to reflect the beliefs of those whom he leads. If you want to know why I'm a Trump Republican, and by the way, Mealy has been from the beginning, it's because only Trump has consistently and effectively put into words the values and beliefs I was armed with long before he appeared on the scene. The mistake that has been repeated throughout Trump's candidacy and presidency, overestimating Trump's persuasiveness and underestimating the savvy of his audience. It wasn't Trump who shaped the conservative movement in America, but rather the conservative movement that shaped Trump, like Pygmalion, into the political embodiment of heartland American values: free speech, law and order, good jobs, secure borders, equality, and not equity. He goes on to essentially put an exclamation point on it, saying his genius was recognizing the spirit of the times and riding it into the White House. And if you want to know, he concludes, why I'm a dead-ender, a Trump Republican to the end, it's this: no one else will fight like hell for the country I grew up in, the country I believe in, and the country that my forefathers died for. Trump may not be perfect, neither am I. But he damn sure didn't have to hypnotize me or manipulate me or mislead me to get me on his side. I think that's a really important point that's lost in all the Trump analysis. To some extent, we don't start from the premise of the left in dismissing Trump supporters as unsophisticated rubes, credulous boomer rubes and deplorables, of course. But we perhaps don't make the point the way that Mealy did, that Trump came to the table to reflect a viewpoint and an authenticity in advance of that viewpoint that was absent, thus the market opportunity that was there and the opportunity that Donald Trump sees like perhaps no other could, particularly in 2016. Interesting. For more on this topic and that in the context of all that transpired over the weekend at CPAC, where she was there.
Ooh, lucky.
We're pleased to be joined by Amber Athey. She's a Washington editor for The Spectator, senior Blankley fellow at the Steamboat Institute, and host of Unfit to Print for The Daily Caller. Amber, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
What about Frank Mealy's observation there about sort of it was the Trump voters that helped to shape Trump, not the other way around? And this is something that the D.C. press corps has consistently missed because they consistently dismiss Trump voters.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. When I talked to family members of mine who supported Trump from the very beginning, the common refrain was, he's talking about things that I've been thinking and haven't been able to say or express for such a long time. Things like, why are we still in war in Afghanistan? Why are we still agreeing to trade deals that are bad for the American manufacturer, bad for the American worker? Why are we allowing amnesty for all of these illegal immigrants who cross our border and in some cases turn out to be violent criminals. So when they saw Trump saying these things, it was refreshing. It wasn't that they had never heard this before. It was that they had never heard a politician say it before.
And another observation from CPAC, and get your take on this, because I think you're a little younger than this demographic, but I was talking to Scott McKay from the Hayride yesterday, and we're talking about, you know, two of the rising stars that were featured at CPAC that are very much in Trump's orbit, but they're their own people as well, Governors Noem of South Dakota and DeSantis of Florida. And he said basically his observation was, you know, this is Trump and Gen X Trump supporters that are now ascendant, that have essentially taken over the party, and they're probably, and that reality is probably best reflected in those two governors.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what was most important about those two governors is actually the message that they had to share. It wasn't just we support the president, but they were able to successfully reiterate these policies that we're talking about. DeSantis, for example, talked about immigration restriction. Governor Noem talked about not subjecting the residents of her state to these strict COVID lockdowns, and instead championing personal responsibility and the choice of businesses to indicate whether or not they want to have a mask mandate or whether or not they want to shut down. And it's really the Trumpism that will outlast Trump, I think. If Trump decides not to go for the presidency in 2024, it's going to be the ideology that's more important than the loyalty. Obviously, supporting him is important to these people, but they also don't want to support someone who's blindly loyal to Trump without having that policy, that ideology background as well.
Well, somebody who was impressed by Trump's speech was Nikki Haley, who, you know, in February 2021, he went down a path he shouldn't have, and we shouldn't have followed him. And then she says after his CPAC speech, now she's supporting him again. And just wanted to get your reaction to that.
Well, she's the perfect example of what I was just talking about, right? She claims to support the president. She served in his administration. But when it comes down to it, on ideology, she's a neocon, and she wavers at every opportune moment. She doesn't have the backbone required to stand up for conservatives who for a long time felt like they're constantly ceding ground to the left, like their priorities were not spoken about unless they were politically popular until Trump came along. So Nikki Haley really represents a return to the type of sort of spineless, opportunistic Republican that used libertarian economics and warmongering foreign policy and tried to sell that to people who didn't have any better option.
Yeah, and she got caught, too, with the statement that she made in February that was just referenced. And now she's trying to get back in good graces that that moment has passed. And Trump is, I mean, perhaps more popular, at least within the wide swath of Republican ranks than he's ever been.
Yes, exactly. And when you look at the CPAC polling, it shows that Trump is still really popular, but he's not the end-all be-all for the party anymore, because he had something like a 95% approval rate among the CPAC attendees, but only just over 50%, about 55%, said that they would vote for him in the 2024 primary. And coming up closely behind him, of course, is Ron DeSantis. And when you take Trump out of that poll, Ron DeSantis gets about 46, 47%. In the 2024 primary. So there's room for a lot of voices in the party. I think it's encouraging to see that there are quite a few leaders that are coming up out of the grassroots America and making their voices heard, because if Trumpism is going to be successful long-term, it has to be more than just one guy.
And you have written about Florida recently, yeah, over at The Spectator. You posit the question, why does anyone still live in the northeastern United States? Did you find out why that is? Because I don't know either.
Yeah, or Midwest, you should have put.
Yeah, well, as someone who lives in D.C., I can tell you that I am strongly contemplating why I'm still here. I mean, most of it is for work, as I imagine a lot of people, you know, in D.C. and New York are as well. But I had such a great time in Florida, and not just because of the, you know, loose coronavirus restrictions and being able to sit at a bar without a mask and have a good time, but also there's just this culture there that's very non-judgy. Everyone does their own thing, and there's, and that's celebrated, the idea that you can go out and have a good time. You don't take yourself too seriously. You can make your own choices. It's just a culture of freedom that you really can't experience in the Northeast.
Amber Athey, Washington editor for The Spectator, senior Blankley fellow at the Steamboat Institute, and host of Unfit to Print for The Daily Caller. Amber, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, I mentioned Gen Xers, and that has drawn the attention of one Kevin from Austin, Texas. Kevin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. You know, we're the generation. I grew up in Oak Park. We grew up in the 70s and 80s. We came home when the streetlights were on. Yep. We played Kick the Can. You know, things like that. It was before the extreme paranoia of being kidnapped and things like that. And, you know, it's our generation that has to get involved in going to school board meetings, going to local, you know, talking, finding out who your rep is, who your state rep is, who your state senator is, and getting involved. Otherwise, if you don't get involved, you're going to be ruled by your better or your lessers. I forget who it says that, Socrates or something like that. So it's, you know, getting involved. I left years ago, and I know you're probably going to say that. I came down to Austin, Texas. I'm glad I did. But, you know, when I go back, it's a shame to see. I feel like I'm going behind the Berlin Wall.
No, it's true.
Seeing what life is like in East Germany. You know, and it's I get involved down here because I'm in an area where they're trying to, you know, creep in. And they actually have. They're spending a lot of money to try to change or turn Texas blue. Okay. But, you know, I encourage everybody to get involved. Even if it's just a phone call. It takes 10 phone calls to change a politician's mind.
Thanks for the call, Kevin.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, and I wanted to play this, too, because kids are so happy to be back at school. Listen to little James. He's in third grade. He could be your hypothetical child.
It's nice because today we don't have to be on our computers that much anymore.
It was very exciting that we were actually, like, close, like, kind of close to each other, and it was good to see them again.
Uh-huh. And then we learned that math is racist.
And then they took away my Dr. Seuss book that I was reading. And mommy's going to sell it now for $2,500 after school because it's worth more than the minivan.
Right. And after snacks, I had to apologize for the rest of the afternoon for being white. What else is going on at school? Yeah, it's nice to be back for the kids. I get it. But good grief. All right.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.